Welcome, Sega fans, and hello, dreamers, to the podcast where the skies are blue, the swirls are orange, and Sonic is constantly running around 3D heads. It's the Sega guys, me, Dan the Mega Driver, and the Geralt my katana is James the Sagaholic. How you doing, mate?
I'm very good, mate, very good. How's yourself?
Very good, mate, very good. Celebrated my 40th birthday in a couple of weeks, having a party recently, but I don't think that makes me feel as old as the fact that the Dreamcast is 25 years old as of when this video will go out.
Yes, at the time of recording, obviously we like to do things in advance, but this episode is going out on 27th of November. 25 years, mate, where has that gone? Where has that gone?
It's absolutely flown by. And it's quite funny because when I was looking, you know, refreshing my memory before doing this episode, there was a reference to Sonic CD in one of the magazines, and then I think it was Sagasa Sanshiro in Sega Saturn magazine said he's more popular than Sonic CD. And I thought, do you know what? Between Sonic CD launching in 1993 and the Sega Dreamcast launching in 1998, that felt like a lifetime. I mean, that felt like forever. The last 25 years.
It's way quicker than the snap of Thanos' fingers.
Yeah, it feels like we've been in the blip.
Aye, pretty much, mate. Except we've come back out the other side older. The people in the blip came back the same and everybody else had aged new. You know, this kind of trend that's going about just now on X, where, you know, post a picture of when GTA 5 came out and now.
Yeah.
Aye.
It's not fair. I mean, you meant to get one or the other, where somewhere we've got both.
Aye, it's like, you know, some people have told me, you know, I've done not bad out of it, but that's because they don't see the filter that's on, and, you know, the headphone and lighting hides the copious amounts of grey going round the side. But yes, mate, we are here to celebrate the birthday of this magnificent console.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, and here we are.
So we've done a Dreamcast video before. Well, no, Dreamcast video. We've done a Dreamcast podcast before, which maybe I'll try and turn into a video at some point. But yeah, that was very much talking about the anniversary of the death of the Dreamcast. I think it's 20 years since it had been discontinued. And we talked about it, you know, about its life and, you know, our journey with it. But, you know, there's a lot, full lot of celebration of the Dreamcast. I imagine we'll be around this time. People talking about the best games, etc., etc. But you had the fantastic idea to talk about it's kind of the journey that we had. As Sega fans, starting from early 97, maybe even late 96, when the rumours were swirling around. And this is kind of our boots on the ground recollection discussion. You know, just kind of what was going on, what we were seeing, what we were thinking, you know, the thoughts and feelings going through that time and going all the way through from that start to the reveal to the launch until we picked up our own Dreamcast. So, and some of this, you know, some of this will be things we have discussed on podcasts before, but I think it's great to have that journey in here. And you know, and for anyone that's new, hopefully this will be entertaining for you. Hopefully it's entertaining for everyone.
Aye, and I think it's something as well that we have touched on certain aspects that are going to be in this, but I think kind of going through that kind of journey, as you say, from when you first heard about it, the unveiling, what you were reading in the magazines, the rumours, the performance talk, all that kind of stuff. It's kind of what we do best on here is kind of we try and educate while, you know, giving an insight into our own kind of upbringing and personal kind of memories and feelings at the time. So hopefully we managed to do it a bit of justice and you can try and get an insight into just what it was like to be looking forward to the Dreamcast when it was new and, you know, what the kind of expectations of the industry were for it, given that we're in a kind of period now, obviously way, way down the line, 25 years as we're saying, where I think the narrative around the console is very different now. So it's to try and maybe give a flavour as to just what was expected of this whenever it was brand new.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, and, you know, as we refresh our memory going through some of the material that we had in our hands when we were, you know, younger, you know, what was I? I would have been 14. You would have been in your teens as well, you know, and where our minds were, I mean, and this starts off, you know, right back in the era of the Saturn. And I think when I was reading this, and I kind of remembered that I was a little bit naive in that I'd only just, as early as 1997, I'd only just got my Sega Saturn. I'd got it for Christmas 1996, or just before. And, you know, the rumors started swirling around the Saturn successor. But for me, I thought that was normal. And I was thinking, why did I think that was normal? Even though, you know, some of the wider discussions before them were around, you know, if you looked at certain magazines and certain bits of media, they'd say the Saturn's failing. But I don't think anyone really reflects on the scale of the failure was then. But for me, I remember thinking, yeah, the next one will be coming, because I think it's, as a Sega fan of kind of my age, I'd come into the Mega Drive and Master System 1991, 1992. And already around that time, we'd had the Mega CD, rumours of that, and there was discussions of the Sega Saturn in 1993 as well, like literally, again, a year and a bit after I'd got my Mega Drive. You know, again, blissfully unaware that it had been around for over 3 years in Japan before that. But it all seemed normal to me, so I didn't really think, I was like, that's great, I've just got this. But it was interesting. I think that was when there was still those very early discussions around Jirao and Kitano. And I think at that stage, it was just very high level, wasn't it? We didn't hear much in those early rumours.
No, the whole Kitano and Black Belt stuff, when that came out, you know, was like, you know, Saturn's successor. You know, found, I think it was in one of the Sega Saturn magazine issues, way before the kind of new challenge conference, but it was like the rumblings were coming out of Japan that Sega were going down this kind of dual kind of route in terms of development. But it's interesting, you're saying obviously you were like 14, kind of at that, you're talking about like kind of like 98 kind of period, 97, 98. So
yeah.
I'm 4.5 years older than you, so. I've just been outed as the old bastard from the podcast duo. That's fantastic. But I think as well, your and I's outlook would have been very different, because you're what, 14, coming up for 15, whereas I'm like 18, 19. So for me, I'm at that age where, and I vividly remember, I just wanted the latest tech. Like it wasn't just as like a Sega fan, but I was like, looking for like the net, like DVD, for example, an imported Region 1 DVD over a year before it came out in the UK. I wanted to have the latest stuff. So that was another major aspect to like Dreamcast as well, is that you were reading all this stuff and you were hearing the rumours of the performance. You know, the one common trend that you'll hear mentioned a lot as we talk through this is Model 3. Because... Yeah. Dreamcast was meant to be the Model 3 killer. It was meant to be Model 3 in the home, and it's a reference you will hear, as I said, throughout. But those early rumblings, you know, you were getting the whole excuse me, Kitano, Black Belt, and there was no like design stuff. It was just the kind of general rumblings to talk about that it would be capable of Virtua Fighter 3. That was a kind of the benchmark. Virtua Fighter 3 was called, you know, the 3D benchmark at that point.
Yep.
And either Kitano or, you know, Black Belt were going to, you know, meet that and exceed it. But as you find out as we go on, each bit of information, snippet of news, bit of hype, it just snowballed, and this thing just got more and more exciting.
It did. It's quite strange when I look back at a lot of this, and I think when there's those first rumours, and I think I'm trying to think of the best way to go ahead and probably the best way to move ahead and come back. Before the actual Dreamcast reveal in Sega Saturn magazine, there was that article right at the beginning that said that they'd agreed the deal with Power VR. Mm-hmm. And that was very much using Unreal as kind of an example of the sort of graphics it'll be. And Unreal at the time was like, wow. But in my mind, between that and both Power VR and 3DFX didn't quite meet those iterations that were out there at that time. And 3D accelerators had been through that, what, second, third generation?
Mm.
It was Voodoo 2 3DFX, wasn't it?
Yep. I had one of them in my PC. Voodoo 2. Gave me a MotoGP demo, a game of some motorbike game. It's like, oh, look at all these wonderful, very flat but textured polygons. That's very nice.
But it still didn't seem feasible.
No.
That it was going to catch Model 3. And I think it's lost quite easily these days, in that Model 3 was just light years ahead of everything else that was out there. You know, even in our wildest dreams, you know, we've talked about the Virtua Fighter 3 Saturn port a few times, and it's always seemed fanciful. There's always these talk about a 3D accelerator, or you see these mock-ups of a 32X hanging out the cartridge slot of a Saturn, but that was the case. I mean, it was Model 3 was so far ahead of the curve. You know, and you had things like Virtua Fighter 3, you had things like Scud Race, you had things like Daytona USA 2. It looked, there was nothing in the home that looked anywhere close. I mean, the PC still wasn't even close to kind of Model 2 graphics, really, was it? I think that's the thing that I think is lost on a lot of people today. They don't have that perspective about how far ahead Sega's AMD, R&D AM departments were.
Aye, and I said it in the Scud Race video that we did. You know, to me, Scud Race still looks and feels like the future. And that's just the allure that it had back then, and that it's managed to hold on to. Like, Scud Race doesn't look like a 1996 game.
No.
You know, think about that. 1996, it's unbelievable. Even Daytona USA 2, which is kind of a couple of years later, you know, it's still incredible when people will... By the way, the point this has came out, we'll have been enjoying it on Like a Dragon, yeah. Gaiden, you know. So, Model 3 really was insanely far ahead of anything. Whenever you've seen a Model 3 arcade game, you were blown away. It was the future. It felt unattainable.
Yeah.
And then you're hearing talk about this home console is going to do that. You know, it's like, whoa, really? Like, Sega, the whole welcome to the next level. The rumours kept going. You're like, really not. You're playing the Lost World, you're looking at VF3, you're seeing Scud Race, you're seeing Daytona 2, and you're going, no. In the home?
Yeah.
No.
But, because, you know, Model 1 did seem attainable from a Saturn and PlayStation perspective. Model 2 was, again, unobtainable. From that performance wasn't obtainable. And we were still in a period where the arcade was still king.
Yes.
And still king by a massive margin. And consoles were always playing catch-up. And PC, as kind of a forerunner, as kind of the front-runner of the home market, wasn't where it was. It was still kind of... We had those early indications in the 3D FX and PowerVR chipsets, but they didn't give us a reason to think that the arcade was going to be surpassed. So that's when... Those early discussions on 3DFX versus PowerVR 2 or 4, they're both going to be fine. They won't be Model 3 quality, but they'll be good.
Aye. You know, and again, as you kind of start moving through and hearing, as we say, the performance stuff, and we've been going through a lot of the kind of the older issues of Sega Saturn magazine, some of the stuff from Edge, which we're going to come on to as well, where you start getting the kind of snippets, obviously, you know, the iconic issue, mm-hmm. you know, that we'll get onto as well. Which is still my absolute favourite Edge cover. I just think, well, I say that, I left mine, it should be darker orange.
I was thinking.
I left it on the windowsill in the summer, and it got bleached. Within like 4 hours or so, I just left it, they got bleached. So, but inside is still that beautiful burnt orange and silver writing. Oh, what a piece that is. Unbelievable. And there's plenty of stuff in that we can talk about. But yeah, aye, the arcade, to think that it was going to be surpassed with something that just felt, you know, fancy, you know, kind of complete fantasy at that time. But as we've seen, things would happen.
So, I mean, talking from a boots on the ground perspective, obviously we'd heard the rumours that there was a 3D FX chipset and that there was a PowerVR one. And I don't think it was covered an awful lot about, you know, that Sega had these two competing projects and was going to pick the best one. And obviously the 3D FX one was driven by Sega of America, the PowerVR one driven by Sega of Japan.
Yep.
And again, at the time, it was just rumours until, you know, there was that leak from 3D FX as they kind of went public. And
yep, and that kind of, I think that gave Sega of Japan the ammunition they needed. I think SOG were always wanting to go with Sato's design. I think the history that Sato has, you know, and the kind of clout that he's got with Sega of Japan, I think they were always kind of wanting to pull for that. But whenever, obviously, 3DFX went public, and as a result, all their kind of projects and whatnot were laid bare, and there it was mentioned that, you know, Sega's console was something they were working on, their next console. And it's never been officially, there's never been a quote that I can see attributed to, you know, confirm or deny anything, but it's said that Sega of Japan were irked by that leaking, that it annoyed them that much that they just went, right, pulled the plug on it, which then led to the lawsuit, because CDFX were then annoyed, and so on and so forth. But we found out later on that these were kind of competing projects. My memory from it was, going back to it, is that the name was a change. Like, it was like the development kind of, it moved from Black Belt to Katana.
Yeah.
It was like, it wasn't two products competing, as you said. It was one. So it felt like more like this is a new iteration of, as information has come out now that we know that it was the two competing designs. But back then, at that point, when it was being reported, you had no idea that was the case.
Yeah, that was it. It was just like, you were just taking these from the rumor mill and just, and to be honest, obviously this is the days that are pre-internet. You don't have, you know, there's leakers, but they're leaking to the press, and no one's able to kind of take all that information and pull it together and kind of connect the dots. Mm-hmm. Everyone was just taking what it was. Oh, there's a, they're going with NEC now. Oh no, they're going with 3DFX. But I think you're right. I think Sega Japan, as much as they were trialing the 3DFX approach, I think they wanted to go with the Sato design. You know, it was with Hitachi, which they obviously still had a good relationship with after the Sega Saturn. It was with NEC, another Japanese company, and it allowed them to get more control. I was looking at kind of, and this isn't kind of from memory, but I was doing this today, looking at whether I could find a benchmark between the PowerVR 2 and the 3DFX Voodoo 2. Uh-huh. Graphics boards, but I couldn't find anything conclusive. I did go into a Google thread, like one of the message boards from back in the day, and it was basically like going into a modern day Twitter account with people flaming each other. But there has been, someone has raised before that the 3DFX solution may have been more powerful, but I don't think that's ever been confirmed.
There is the quote from, I don't know if it's Sato or someone on the R&D team, but that the PowerVR variant yielded similar or better performance for cheaper. So I think they were trying to balance getting just enough power, you know, but obviously for that kind of cost, because they didn't want to repeat the kind of the price of the Saturn. So that's the only quote that's out there, is that, you know, PowerVR did give similar performance but for a lot cheaper. But it would have been interesting to see. I mean, as we get to the Japanese launch, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but in the end, the decision to go with NEC was actually detrimental, because, like, as Sega said, they could have sold an extra 300,000 units pre-orders at launch if it wasn't for the PowerVR2 chip shortage. So, you know, a decision that, you know, some people might say that was karma, you know, 3DFX maybe putting a spelling, casting some voodoo on the, to use our pun, you know, got their own back for the deal being kind of scuppered, but
pins in the Dreamcast.
That's it, you know.
But yeah, it would have been interesting. I do wonder, much like one day the Nintendo PlayStation was unearthed, I wonder if there's a black belt kit somewhere out there, a black belt prototype. That would be really cool.
I think there would have to be, wouldn't there? There must be something kicking about.
Something that someone's cobbled together.
Aye.
You know, it's a proof of concept.
To demonstrate, oh, this is what it could do. There must be something.
Yeah.
In somebody's basement or something.
Yeah, because I think those early prototypes were used for some demos for developers, but I think probably the next thing to get onto is, while these rumors are swirling about and getting more vocal and stronger, and of course, the head of Sega America, Mr. Bernie Stolar, is asked about these rumors, and his response is, "The Saturn is not our future." And I think that was when I had the realization that, okay, we're going to be moving on from Sega Saturn soon. I still didn't have an idea of how dire it was. I mean, we're going to move on from Sega Saturn soon, and you know, got to get ready for what comes next. And that was kind of when I think everyone realized, and everyone kind of had that confirmation with all the rumors that were circulating, with all the Jarrell, Katana, Black Belt, 3D effects, Power VR 2 discussions, and with Bernie uttering that line, that was it then. It was coming. And obviously Bernie at this point has seen it, and it is one of those things, and you can kind of, we know what we know now in the financial year 97 documents that we've seen, and obviously what he inherited at Sega of America, and he must have walked in and gone, oh my God. you know, the Saturn at that time, and we're seeing a sales spike in terms of console sales, but obviously he's seen some of these prototypes and he knows what's coming.
In a way, looking at it, I can see what Bernie was trying to say. I think if he'd worded it better, saying, you know, oh, wait, because as you rightly said, he's seen the prototypes, he's been seeing this thing coming together, he's seen the Fisco documents and went, oh my God, this place is a shit show. And then I think if he'd maybe went, oh, well, you know, we're building for the future, or, you know, wait till you see what we've got around the corner, we've got, you know, it's exciting. I think if he tried to, but he's, I think Bernie was a very blunt man. I think that he was man who, he got to the point, a bit like myself at times, just to the point, says what he wants to say, and that's it. And I think he's just went, yeah, Saturn's not our future, because he's getting into that thinking, I've seen these financial results, you have no idea what's going on behind the scenes, I've seen this new tech that's coming, and you're going to be blown away by it, so this thing's not our future. And I think I can see where, because of the kind of the way he delivered, if you look at kind of past interviews like on the G4 stuff and things like that, he is very to the point, and I think he just maybe worded it a wee bit too abruptly.
But if you're Bernie, and coming on to the next point I've got in my notes, behind closed doors, they were demoing these prototypes. And, you know, sometime after that, that's when there's a rumor in an American magazine, and I think we heard about it in SSM to an extent, that the Scud Race demo was being shown to developers, apparently put together in a matter of weeks. And it's a demo that you've shared on the channel in your brilliant Scud Race documentary.
Yep.
Little banner will come up there, tell you to click on that. I'll remind you too if you haven't seen it already. But it says in the article that I was reading today, I couldn't find the Sega Saturn magazine one, but the one that I was reading was saying how in many ways it surpassed the Model 3 original. I can't say that's entirely my perception from looking at the demo, but it does talk about additional detail on the cars, and I don't know if it's worth looking at those car models using that demo again, but even just reading that sort of stuff, all of a sudden you're like, and you know, going back to what we were just saying about Model 3 being the benchmark, that's kind of mind-blowing that could exist. But even getting close to Model 3 at the time would have been mind-blowing.
I mean, I remember the demo. So you've got the bridge demo, which shows the Porsche 911 and the McLaren F1 racing across. It's a kind of like a Golden Gate Bridge style kind of, and it's a kind of across water, and it's got lots of, it's set at night, and there's lots of lovely, I mean, the footage is on the video that I did. Now, it's very blurry, so it's hard to see. Now, in the video that I do say that I think, looking at it, the actual branding seems to be missing.
Like,
yeah. If you look, it's really hard to tell, but I can't see like the BPR logos on the side, which are quite prominently white and red, so they would have been quite noticeable. I couldn't make them out. Where the Gulf, you know, logos and things like that, the kind of the sponsors, were they off? Hard to tell from a bloody video, but I couldn't make out the BPR logo. So it does make me lean towards the fact that it was going to come. Like, it was a tech demo, but I think the intent was there to bring it. And as I said in the video, I don't know whether it's for licensing reasons or for whatever that they decided not to go ahead with it. But yeah, the logos don't appear to be on the cars, but they do look, like even in that bloody video, they look gorgeous. They match the arcade models perfectly. The metallic surfaces are reflecting light. Everything about them is, now again, it's only two cars on a bridge going over water. There's no massive track detail, no other cars on track to. So it's probably chumming all its power into just generating just these two cars in this background. But you also get the Dolphin Tunnel, which you know, you've seen that, it's kind of, the camera zooms in and goes all the way around the track and through the tunnel and all that. And Laurent Combi as well, he's got that on his channel as well, and he allowed me to use the footage that he's got, because he's got that tech demo off of a dev kit and uploaded it, and that's on the video as well. And there's also details on there if you want to run that tech demo on your PC. So again, it's worth checking out. There's tons of stuff in there. But aye, the Scud Race one was exciting. I remember seeing the stills in Sega Saturn magazine, and it was like, oh my god, Scud Race is coming home. It can do Scud Race. And again, if you've seen, put yourself in the mindset of someone in like late 97, mid or kind of early 98, and you're kind of hearing these rumours, and then you get this screenshot coming out, and you've seen this game in the arcade, and then you've went home and you're playing your Saturn, which you love, and even Sega Rally, the very best the Saturn can offer, isn't close to this. And you're all of a sudden being told that this is running on what you're going to have in the home.
Yeah, and I've got the actual article up now, and I think it's the May 98 issue with the Panzer Dragoon Saga demo disc.
Ha, there you go.
And it's got the screenshots of Scud Race in there. It talks about it, shows Scud Race demo shows incredible potential. Machine's power is at least equal to Model 3, and which was unreal at the time. And I think you took it, and this is where we kind of have this time lapse where you've got Bernie saying the Saturn is not our future, and you've got a few more rumours around what's happening with 3DFX and Power VR, but then it all goes fairly quiet until it starts ramping up again now.
Yep.
I saw the article in the other magazine, which talks about that the cars have more detail. So I don't know if it's talking about polygonal, like the cars have more detail, more geometry compared to the. I know you're talking about the missing sponsors, but whether they have more geometry, and then you have this in Sega Saturn magazine, and it just at that point it just seems like this thing is must be unreal, because again, as we said, Model 3 was the benchmark. And then it goes a little bit quiet again until we get to the new Challenge conference. And then that's when everything changes almost overnight. And it's quite interesting that it comes after Panzer Dragoon Saga, kind of the last fully polished kind of big marquee release for the Saturn goes out. It's like, that's out now. Let's share the big guns.
Aye, it was Saturn was allowed its swan song, you know, was allowed to go out with a bang with Saga, as well as like Burning Rangers as well, House of the Dead, Shining Force 3, that kind of last, like Deep Fear as well. It got its kind of last hurrah, last kind of wave of first-party releases, and then aye, the new Challenge conference, which literally had, you know the biggest celebrities, you know, from across the gaming industry. There was like... I think it was the sumo wrestlers that were there as well. There was like Sagata Sanshiro was there.
Yeah, and soap stars there in the Sega Saturn magazine article. Soap actress was attracting plenty of attention at the Sega party. And you got a picture of Mr. Ledbetter himself with Yuji Naka.
That's right.
It seems like a massive gig that they had going on there.
Aye, they pulled out all the stops. And the actual conference, there's footage of it on YouTube now as well to view. Which is absolutely great, because again, this issue of Edge that I've mentioned, issue 60, you know, with the iconic, you know, heading, you know, Sega is dead, long live Dreamcast. Because at the conference itself, even though they unveiled the name, it wasn't just meant to be a name. And this is what was very startling at the time as well to read. that headline was really stark, because you're going, oh, hold on, and then you go through it, and in the actual article itself, it does show the console here, but there's no Sega branding at all.
No.
On the console. Now, the idea was that Sega were going to go forward and operate under the brand of Dreamcast. That was the talk at the time, was yeah. that the Sega brand was too damaged in terms of what had happened with the Saturn, the 32X, and they wanted to kind of move away and try and create this kind of ubiquitous brand to operate under and let Dreamcast stand on its own. Now, when we spoke to Peter Moore, because I know he's mentioned in previous interviews that he wanted it put on the packaging in North America that it's the Sega Dreamcast. He thought the Sega name still had a lot of kind of relevance and strength. But the way I put the question to him was to try and see, I wanted to know who said to put the name back on the console. And Peter did allude to the fact that he said, no, I told the Japanese guys that, you know, it has to be the Sega Dreamcast. Now, whether SOJ listened to Peter Moore and that if he's picked my question up properly and he's answered it as he has, then we've got that on the front, because, you know, Peter Moore said that there was a lot of value in the name. But at the time, it was very much a brand, and that's what they showed on the screen. You know, they did have the Sega logo on the kind of projectors behind them, but they vanished, white screen, orange swirl, produced Dreamcast everywhere. And Sega was nowhere to be seen in that. That in itself, actually, I remember being, I think sad's the wrong word, kind of be sad about it, but it felt like kind of change, almost yeah. an unnecessary change. I felt like, oh, this is a bit kind of, a bit drastic.
Yeah, I had exactly the same reaction. And as excited as I was for what I saw at the time, it kind of cooled me down a little bit, because I thought, well, why is Sega so afraid to be Sega? Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean? Which is a strange thing, because Sega have basically reinvented themselves with every single console they have. you know, what Mega Drive games did the Saturn have on it? What's the Mega Drive series? It had none. But it did kind of feel drastic, and it did feel like they were kind of shedding their identity a little bit, yes. which was worrying. Because if you were, like we were, an avid reader of Sega Saturn magazine, it meant you were fully invested in that console. And we said many times, for us, the Saturn is the Sega console, the most Sega console, the most inventive, the most daring, and the one that harkens back to its arcade roots. And I know that some of that did kind of become a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of what the Dreamcast tried to do, the sort of games that it tried to push. But yeah, at the time it was quite alarming, because he's like, well, why are you afraid? Why is Sega afraid to be Sega?
You've got nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
Just be yourselves. It was jarring to actually read that they wanted to drop their name.
Yeah, because you see it in all the photos. There's no Sega name on the Dreamcast. There's Dreamcast banners everywhere, but it's all just Dreamcast. It doesn't say Sega Dreamcast. It's all just Dreamcast. So it's a complete shedding of that Sega identity and just jumping behind his Dreamcast name, which, again, it's... You and I have spoke before about the orange swirl, and the orange swirl was what we... You know, that was imprinted on us from this very yep. first reveal.
Yep.
I think that early exposure to it, and us being exposed to that logo without the Sega branding, in isolation, as this is the brand new exciting thing, I think that's probably why we do have the attachment to the Japanese logo.
The orange resonates with us so much because we were so invested in that. Not just the Dreamcast rumours and the build-up to the kind of launch and whatnot and the unveiling, but because we were invested in that whole Sega ecosystem, because you're in Sega Saturn magazine, you're seeing like the leaks. If you look at the pictures of the last five issues of Sega Saturn magazine, they had the wee Japanese yeah. kind of corner with the it's orange with a white swirl. And again, there's a white swirl, James. See if there's one in orange background. You know what I mean? But Aye, it's just it was imprinted at a very early stage, and the kind of following the console, and I think that's why, to me, the blue, despite it being Sega's primary colour, for this console, it just feels alien. Which I suppose, in a way, did Sega actually succeed in moving away from their own brand?
I suppose they did to an extent, because you know? but then they have the Irumajiri demo.
Yes,
comes up, which I was watching. It was looking at the stills in the magazine. I was blown away by the fidelity of it all. Obviously, all we'd seen before, the closest we'd seen is the Mario 64 title screen where you can put on his nose.
Clearly inspired by the Mario 64.
But, I mean, I watched a video of the Irumajiri video earlier, the demo earlier, and watching it now, the eyes kind of, you know, you have that uncanny valley and you can tell that it's... But at the time, looking at stills, it looks absolutely incredible, like the detail and the texture on the face, and it looked like a real head. And I'd imagine if I saw, you know, it starts off with the photograph of him.
That's right.
And then he stretches through and then pops into 3D. But despite all of that, and, you know, them shedding all the Sega branding, they still had Sonic the Hedgehog running around his head.
That's right. Yep. But the tech demo itself for that, there's a lot going on. You've got the Sonic running around his head. You've got like multiple smaller versions of the head going all over the place. You've got the Jarrell style metallic effect on his whole head. You've got the three lights that change colours to show the kind of the light sourcing that it shines on. And then you've got the one where his head's in the middle of like a kind of Japanese city, almost like Godzilla with helicopters with their spotlights shining down.
That I'm 100% sure is Speed Highway from Sonic Adventure now.
Isn't it?
That's what it is.
I'm literally looking at the screenshot just now and I think you're right.
Yeah, I'm 100%. Even the helicopters are the same. And I say that because I was playing Sonic Adventure before I logged on and because I was playing Sonic Generations on that stage in the week. And even the light sourcing, like the way that the light, the sparkles move around his head, that seems to be from Sonic Adventure as well, the way that moves around, because when you get the flashback with Takao and it moves around the character. But yeah, and when he first comes into the screen, you don't see this in the magazines, we didn't notice at the time, you just see where his head's been severed or his head is floating. He's got a Dreamcast swirl in it.
That's right. He's got a Dreamcast swirl in his face.
Yeah.
Just covering it. But I mean, the Irumajiri head wasn't the only tech demo at the new Challenge Conference. We did have the brilliant Babylon, or Tower of Babylon. Now,
that was the Yu Suzuki one, wasn't it?
It was, mate. That was a dog trying to come in there. But aye, so that was a Yu Suzuki demo. Now, I'm just going to kind of read a bit out of there, because Edge did, they were really impressed by this. So scattered around the foot of the central tower were scores of houses, each marked with high-resolution textures. Zooming close into the buildings simply resulted in more and more detail becoming clear, with no hint of frames being dropped. The lighting was dynamic and switchable between night and day. High-end accelerated PCs offer a similar performance, but when launched, Dreamcast will offer £2,000 worth of performance for £150. Tempted, Edge suspects the best is yet to come.
Now, what struck me when that, and this is, obviously, we had the new Challenge Conference, which came in issue 33, and then you had kind of the breakdown of that whole, both the demos, obviously, Sega Saturn Magazine in 1998, kind of desperate for content.
This must have been a gold mine for them at that point. It's,
yeah,
because it was pages and it was over multiple issues as well.
Yeah, so then they had the whole breakdown of the Babylon demo, and the first thing that strikes me about that is that's Shenmue 2.
And it's very, very. You can see the kind of the influence. You know, it almost reminds me a wee bit of Kowloon.
Yeah, that's exactly what that reminds me of.
Now, again, Laurent Combe has that tech demo on his channel. You can view it. Again, he's got a wrapper to let you run it on your PC if you want to actually play about with it. So it's something if you look at it running, again, take yourself back to early to mid 98 and you're seeing that level of graphical fidelity. You're seeing these type of lighting effects, this kind of dynamic lighting with no frames being dropped, with detail. Doesn't matter how close you get. You think of like House of the Dead 1 on the Saturn. Okay, holding textures or not. You go up to a wall and it's just black and grey squares. Yeah. You're now going through a city with doors, windows, bricks, mud, dirt, everything just in full detail. So it was, and to think about it as well, House of the Dead on Saturn came out in 98.
Yeah.
Months later, you're being shown this level of performance. Are you getting the leap that this was? You know, yeah. It's insane.
Well, I think, and we'll come on to Sonic soon, but I think that at the time of the New Challenge Conference, this was, you know, this was pre-E3, wasn't it? I believe. Yeah. The N64 had not even been out in Japan for 2 years at this point. Now, the Saturn is obviously coming up to 3.5 years old, same with the PlayStation. And both were impressive at the time. The PlayStation wasn't really looking long in the tooth at that point. You know, it's still pumping out, you know, it's still got Metal Gear Solid to come yet. Still got, yes, Final Fantasy VIII. Still got a bunch of guys. I don't know, even know if the first Siphon Filter had been out at this point. So there's still untapped potential in the PlayStation. The N64 has come out and has wowed everyone with Mario 64. Zelda's not out on the N64 at this point. But you know, to us, it was still kind of new technology. You know, the N64 was still cutting edge. And then you have the leap that the N64 was over the PlayStation and Saturn, which was, you know, there was a jump there. You know, the N64 was undoubtedly more powerful, but not so much that when you had releases on, mostly you'd see releases on the PS1 and N64, and they were comparable. But the Dreamcast reveal, again, the time between the Dreamcast reveal and the N64 launch is still round about the same between the Saturn and PlayStation launch and the N64 launch. And that gap is huge. You know, the visual, the jump in visual fidelity, the detail, the sheer scale of everything that's been demonstrated was orders of magnitude beyond what anyone had seen or probably even expected at that point. It was beyond, you know, what we were seeing in the Unreal demo on PC. It was the light years beyond Mario 64. And the talk that it was going to be beyond Model 3 was just, wow, how powerful is this thing?
Yeah. And the Babylon demo and even the Inimajiri demo started, you know, along with the screenshots you've seen of the Scud Race Tech demo. All of a sudden, this picture's getting painted that this wasn't, you know, just bluster from Sega. They are going out to try and bring that level of power into a box to go under your TV for, what, £100?
Yeah.
It was just absolutely crazy. And, you know, as we kind of go on and talk about the kind of the launch games and what would eventually become reality, but at the point where you're still being fed, you know, you're initially being drip-fed this information, now, as you say, it's just foots on the floor. It's just info, info, info. From New Challenge Conference until launch, it was just a barrage of information about Dreamcast, and you just did feel that Sega were serious about, you know, this wasn't a joke, this wasn't, you know, bluster or, you know, fake news, that they are going all out to bring performance beyond Model 3. It's almost like they decided, right, we've had our fun in the arcade, we've kind of toyed with bringing the arcade home, now we're going to pass the arcade home, and that's what it felt like they were going to do.
Yeah, because at this time, the arcade is, it's not as popular as it once was. No. But it's still the premier place to see kind of the latest tech.
Yeah.
But this is where, you know, you get in the interviews at this stage with Sato, with Yu Suzuki, and with the team behind this hardware. And this is where they're starting to say, of course we made this more powerful than Model 3.
Yeah. And that's an issue 34 of Sega Saturn magazine. You know, Yu Suzuki asked about you know, the is it more powerful than Model 3? Of course Dreamcast beats Model 3, he proclaims, saying we wanted to ensure when we ported games to Dreamcast it would be stress-free. You know, so again, this is the main man, the man who led the 3D revolution. Better watch how you say that tonight enough. But you know, if he's saying that and the games that he's worked on and what he's brought to the arcade and he was saying that, you know, I always look at this comment and think, is that's why there must still be untapped power in that Wii box. What's in there that we haven't seen?
Yeah.
For him to say something like that, for what he's seen, I just always wonder what's left in there.
I would have loved to see him tackle Virtua Fighter 3. We'll get onto, you know, the games later on, but I'd love to see him tackle Virtua Fighter 3 for Dreamcast. Obviously, he had Shenmue, and Shenmue was the biggest indication of what the Dreamcast could do. It probably still is. But, you know, is that when they're talking about these demos, I mean, it's issue 34. You've got the info. 33 was the new challenge conference. 34 was the breakdown of all the demos. All the screenshots, there's screenshots galore, and you've got Ira Majiri's head in all these different different textures, like gold, silver, sand, and you've got Sonic running around. It's quite funny to see that Sonic is in his adventure form, but he's got black eyes. He hasn't quite taken on, you know, it's not completely rebuilt at that stage. That comes later.
Yeah.
But one thing that we haven't touched on that is brought on in the new challenge conference, and it's into that in here in a bit more detail, is the visual memory system, which was revealed to us for the first time. And that itself was extremely surprising.
Yes, and I think many people now will, and I think by default we all go to VMU, but yeah, for many a year I called it the VMS. And again, you know, in this issue 60 of Edge, they go through, you know, and they highlight, you know, they say inside the Dream Machine, and they obviously go into the VMS at that point. Now, we had seen Sony doing the Pocket Station, so I think the initial kind of thought was that it was kind of on par with that. We'd see kind of.
I thought the Pocket Station came later, didn't it?
It came out later, but I'm sure we had seen, like, photographs of it. There was something about it coming soon that I vaguely remember that it being, I mean, it might just be my mind playing tricks with me, but I think I'm sure I've seen, like, talk of, like, the Pocket Station, like a memory card with a screen on it for your PlayStation, and that's why, you know, this kind of reminded me of that. But again, the VMS was, whatever you see eventually, what, or the VMU, whenever you, it still feels weird saying VMS now, whenever you said VMU for so long. But when you, again, you go further into the future and you see what was done with it, it didn't really fulfill the plans I think Sega had for it. Yes, it had plenty of kind of wee quirks, you know, like seeing like plays on your screen to hide them for your friends whenever you're playing NFL 2K, mm-hmm. or your health meter, whenever, and your ammo on Code Veronica. If you even wanted to play a match of Virtua Tennis, you can watch it on your controller. If you happen to don't have a telly, you can play tennis with Stickman. And also you had the Chaos, or the Chows, what you might call them, how you pronounce it?
Chows.
You've got them in Sonic Adventure, the kind of Tamagotchi-style thing. But, you know, whenever you go through the Edge article, they kind of position it more as like an accompaniment, sort of almost like a companion peripheral. It was meant to be, they almost worded it as if you were taking your games with you. You take your Dreamcast, not in terms of performance-wise, but it's a small scene, but like an extension that you'd be able to do something with every game on the VMS and then bring it back and then plug it into the Dreamcast and then and carry on something from what you'd done on the move. But an Edge 60, it's a red controller with a circle start button, not a triangle, and the red VMU, it was crazy to see again the design of it, that you had this controller with these two slots in the back and that there was a window for the screen. That in itself just felt like what are the possibilities that you could be doing with this, you know? It was just like, again, the excitement level, something completely different.
Yeah, it was completely original, something that we'd never seen before. Second screened gaming. I don't think we'd ever thought of that before. Certainly, this is a decade before the Nintendo DS, 15 years before the Nintendo Wii U. And yeah, the possibilities were endless. The feeling I got for it, you know, when, you know, people were talking about NetPlay and, you know, there's that whole social element with the Dreamcast. It felt like, and there's this whole thing about the way it was revealed at the New Contract Challenge conference, it just felt like a very social machine rather than, obviously the Sega Mega Drive brought console gaming to the masses. The PlayStation pushed on that, and it seemed like the Dreamcast was aiming to do that, bring that to the next level in terms of socializing. You know, if you can either play online, or you can play with the four controller ports, or you can take this little thing out with you and play with your friends that way.
Aye. And the fact as well that they showed that, you know, they were meant to, you know, you could connect them together. It was meant to be you'd be at one side and your friends at the other, playing against each other on these tiny D-pads and buttons, and the four controller ports as well. You know, obviously N64 had done that, you know, taking up the mantle of the four controller ports, but then for Dreamcast to do that as well, yeah, the whole multiplayer thing again, perhaps a play on the whole arcade, you know, like games, you think of games in the past that you could play, like your Simpsons games and Turtles, where it was four players, the cabinet had the four joysticks all the way around. So again, no, say there was done with the purpose of bringing the Simpsons and Turtles to Dreamcast, but that kind of idea that to get as many people around the console at home as possible, a very social machine is how it came across, absolutely.
So, you know, moving on from the new Challenge conference, obviously the news kind of keeps dripping through now. You know, we get the Godzilla reveal and we start seeing more and more games. We get to the point where there's new Model 3 games being launched, Spike Out being one of them. Yes. I think we talked about in Lost of the Arcade that Mr. Ledbetter was a big fan of Spike Out.
That's right.
And every single game, it was Spike Out, Star Wars Trilogy Arcade as well is being featured, as that's coming out in 1998. And it's kind of fever pitch because every single game that's getting released in the Model 3 Arcade, you think, well, the Dreamcast can do this. The Dreamcast can do this, you know. And then you've got this Godzilla game, and I think everyone needs to forget what they know about Godzilla Generations now, and forget what you know, but think about the fact that we're seeing these screenshots of Godzilla and all these kaiju monsters that are detailed, more detailed than anything that we've ever seen, you know, fully textured. You can see the scales in Godzilla, you know, his reflective eyes, and you can see him stomping through this, you know, really detailed city. And it's just like, this is literally a dream machine, you know, the stuff that it can do. And yeah, as you go through these pages, you're just literally seeing more and more possibilities of what you can expect on this, on the Dreamcast.
What you said there about the wave of Model 3 games is absolutely spot on. You got to this point where you're almost arrogantly, like, you're reading all this information, you're seeing these tech demos, you're seeing these screenshots, and you're looking into the arcade, and you're seeing these games, or even if you're seeing only photographs or previews in Sega Saturn magazine, like Star Wars Arcade, Daytona 2, Spike Out, we played that at home soon. It just felt like you almost had this entitlement that, well, this is what we're getting.
Yeah,
we've seen the performance. This is what we're getting.
No, I vividly remember now, actually. Someone, I was around my friend's house, and his brother was saying, why are you excited about the Dreamcast? You know, why aren't you going to wait for PlayStation 2? I was like, have you seen Star Wars Arcade? It's coming to the Dreamcast, and it's going to shit over everything the PlayStation 2 does from stratospheric heights. It's so good. You just expected it all to come to the Dreamcast. And, well, yeah, if anyone's watched our Lost in the Arcade episode, they know what happened there. But at the time, the possibilities seemed absolutely endless.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, as I say, Godzilla looks amazing in there. There's a bunch of other games in there, like Seventh Cross, which I don't know if that ever saw the light over. It certainly didn't see the light in the West. And then the icing on the cake for this one for me was obviously you get to the opening page just inside the cover, and then you've got the smile and the big monocle eyes of Sonic the Hedgehog saying, "Join us next issue. You can't afford not to."
Aye, it was just, as we say, everything just ramped up at that point. You know, you did just think that, you know, possibilities are endless. You know, just where could this machine go from here? And I remember that, you know, the black page where just the Sonic eyes and the smile, and it was like, oh, finally, you know. Because you think, I mean, we've all spoken on, you know, whether it's be on Shiro or here, about the kind of the lack of Sonic on a Saturn, the reliance that SOA had on Sonic Extreme, the impact that its cancellation had. We've seen it in the 97 fiscal documents that they were relying heavily on this to make an impact. But now finally, Sonic was getting the spotlight that he deserved.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was headlining a new Sega console with this level of performance, and that in itself, you're like, oh my God, what is Sonic going to look like on this thing?
I know. And yeah, that teaser gave you a really slight indication, because his eyes were green. But you knew it was him. You had the smile and you had the eyes. But, and it says Dreamcast Sonic Adventure. So you knew it was him. And straight away, it was like, this is different. This is going to be kind of the next level of Sonic the Hedgehog. And yeah, the next issue, without a doubt, one of my favorite issues of all time, was the Sonic the Hedgehog reveal. Now, before we came on air and I shared a small video of it on X, I'd never seen the actual reveal video before, but this magazine I took to London with me, with a bunch of mates, and I was just reading it non-stop, because we were all going to a Computer Exchange in Rathbone Street to pick up some. This is when CEX was not the Complete Entertainment Exchange. This is when it was Computer Exchange. It's when they chipped your console, let it play imports. It's when they sold imports. And when it was just, you know, it was like an Aladdin's cave in there. So we went there. My friend Charlie went to pick up Radiant Silver Gun and Deep Fear. I went in there and got... Deep Fear was 35 quid, by the way. Got the PAL version. And Radiant Silver Gun was 40 quid. And I picked up Castlevania Symphony of the Night, also 40 quid for the Saturn. And I picked up something else as well. I think it might have been the King of Fighters collection. But I was, you know, I got these games in my bag, which are some of my favorite Saturn games of all time. And I cannot take my eyes away from this magazine. I nearly fell over in the shop still looking at these images, these preview images. Just the sheer scale, just looking at that transparent chaos, was absolutely mind blowing. Looking at just the textures on the floor, you know, looking at the walls and the fire effects and the lighting, and all these new characters. Like, who's this giant cat? Who's this robot that's in there? And it was just, Sonic Adventure is the most hyped I've been for any game ever. And that was there and then. Obviously, getting a Dreamcast went from something in 97 where I was like, well, this will be, that's down the line, I'll get that one day. Sonic Adventure was like, well, I need this as soon as possible. But with it, and that's when, you know, you start seeing everything else that's starting to get unveiled. You've got your Sonic, you're obviously going to get Virtua Fighter 3, you're obviously going to get a port of Sega Rally 2, which is actually mentioned in that Sonic Adventure issue. Interestingly, you don't have any pictures of the Dreamcast version. It just mentions the PC. And I think that's quite telling, considering what Sega Rally 2 turned out like, that they built it for the, you know, we've heard before that it was done on a very, very early Dreamcast development kit. But it does seem like, when you look at the evidence in here, that it was created on PC and then ported later to the Dreamcast.
Aye, and I think the kind of wee chat we had before we came on air as well, you'd said that it's mentioned on there that it's a PC port. So that in a way kind of went against everything they had said before, kind of thing, because like you're hearing about Yu Suzuki saying about stress-free Model 3 ports, but then you're taking PC code. Now, why they chose to port over and use Windows CE for Sega Rally 2, I'll never know. God only knows what led to that decision being made, but yeah, it does seem as if it was ported to PC first and then, you know, transported over to Dreamcast using Windows C, which is just a baffling design choice. But even at that, you're still looking at the screenshots and you're still getting the, I still remember being excited by it.
Well, especially about it talking about a 10-year championship mode and 40 courses. It wasn't quite 40 courses in the end, but that extra content just made me think that this is going to be the greatest. You know, if you take Sega Rally's gameplay, the Saturn port, and couple it with the scope, the number of vehicles, the number of courses that you'd see in some of the bigger racing games like Colin McRae and stuff, you know. If Colin McRae and V-Rally actually played as well as Sega Rally, it's the best racing game ever made, isn't it? So that's what's going through my head at that point. That you know, you've got, then not only is this new super console delivering visuals, but it's delivering content as well. And it's going to be the ultimate games machine.
Aye. But, I mean, the thing that excited me most for Dreamcast, and, you know, it goes back to my sheer love of Virtua Fighter on the Saturn and in the arcade, and it was seeing the footage, even in stills, of the demo for Virtua Fighter 3, seeing Aoi, if I'm pronouncing her name properly, you know, she's moving her arms and doing with the fan, and the material's hanging from her sleeves and it's swaying, the snow's falling, it's deforming under her feet as she's doing her moves, and again, cuts to Pi and the subway, the camera zooms in and she's angry and she's, her eyes scan, you know, the environment, and it's like, oh my word, like, that's what you're going to be playing. And that, I mean, for you, you know, Sonic Adventure, I'm not surprised that Sonic Adventure was the thing that's, you know, got you the most excited, knowing, you know, your sheer love for Sonic and your story about, you know, playing Sonic 1 in the Master System being the catalyst for why we're sitting here. I'm not surprised that Sonic was what got you that excited, but for me it was Virtua Fighter 3. I just had to have that game, and seeing those kind of those screenshots from that demo, where, as I say, the sheer level of detail, like eyes moving, separate fingers, clothes swaying in the wind, I had to have it. Whenever I heard that VF3 was going to be like a launch title, obviously again trying not hear this conversation and think about what VF3 TBE was, as much as I defended it, and I'll always defend it, and it's in a video that I've done recently which will now be up there, if you haven't checked it out, when I say about the job that Genki did, I do believe it is a good one given the time that they had to port it. But I just, VF3, mate, for me, it was like, this is a machine that's going to put Virtua Fighter 3 in my house.
Yeah.
And I need it.
Yeah, and it's just, as I say, Virtua Fighter 3 was still the visual benchmark. You know, there wasn't a Fighting Vipers 2 at that point. Nope. And there wasn't any other fighting game that looked anything like Virtua Fighter 3. Tekken 3 had just come out in the arcade, I think, using this Namco System 23, which it was still light years away from Model 2, let alone Model 3. So the idea of getting Virtua Fighter 3 in the home was mind-blowing. And of, you know, we've talked about just now about how it was kind of felt wishful thinking getting it on the Sega Saturn. And even when you got it on the Sega Saturn, you knew there'd be concessions where it was 2D backgrounds, or there'd be some sort of shortcut. But this seemed like the full fat Virtua Fighter experience. You know, the characters looked exactly as they did in the arcade. It was unmistakable. And you had the 3D backgrounds, you had the undulating floors, it was all there. So it was 100%, you know, something to be hyped about. That was it was the gold standard still.
Yeah. And even in the articles that we're looking at in Sega Saturn magazine and Edge, you know, following on from the New Challenge Conference, that is reiterated several times. Virtua Fighter 3 still remains the 3D benchmark in gaming. So again, you're getting that in the home. And it was just again, that word, or that phrase, Model 3, it was over and over again drummed into his Model 3 in the home. And that's why the hype just got greater and greater and greater as you got towards launch.
Yeah. And, you know, as we go through and we get... The thing is, we get now to kind of the last issue of Sega Saturn magazine, and that's the Dead or Alive 2 reveal, which, you know, what a way to end up. And you've got screenshots of Zombie Revenge. You've got screenshots of House of the Dead 2. You've got screenshots of Blue Stinger. Sega Rally 2's in there in a kind of expanded form. More Virtua Fighter 3. And it says in there, you know, Judgment Day, November 27th, 1998. And that's it. The date is set then. And, you know, the one thing I knew is that I wanted this machine. At this point, you know, if you're a reader of Sega Saturn magazine and a Saturn fan, you've started importing. I'd started importing. I got my machine modded. As I said, I was picking up Castlevania, Symphony of the Night, Radiant Silver Gun. I'd had Marvel Super Heroes versus Capcom at this point. And, yeah, I was desperate for it. But yeah, that lineup of games just looks sensational to me. Especially when you start looking at things like Blue Stinger, which, again, it's a game that, in hindsight and in the reviews at the time, it wasn't everything you expected. But looking at those screenshots there, seeing what looked like a fully 3D take on Resident Evil, it was just another thing to get hyped about.
Aye. And I've got that issue in front of me just now. I'm just laughing because... the customary pages of ads that you used to get for various shops.
Yeah.
At this point, you know, in the classifieds, you've now got every importer offering, you know, Dreamcast with no deposits, order before 15th November, free game if you pre-book before 15th November, free delivery to UK, Christmas delivery guaranteed, you know.
Yeah.
It's just funny seeing that kind of ramp up as well. But yeah, that last issue of Sega Saturn magazine, obviously Naomi getting unveiled, Dead or Alive 2, the focus on it, takes quite a few pages of scantily clad CGI females before you actually get to some screenshots of the game.
I've got a silly story about that.
Right, go then.
I went on holiday with my family, and at the time my uncle came with us. I can't remember why, but it's my dad's brother, and we were split into like three rooms. It's my mum and my mum and dad, my brother and sister, and me and my uncle. And we got down, and I get laid down, and we're about to go to bed, and I pull my magazine out, which is this one, put it on the side. It's, oh, damn, what we got here? Picked it up. So, you know, what's this about? Sorry, it's a Sega Saturn magazine. He's like, Christ's sake, Dan, I thought you'd brought a Tug Mac with you.
Oh, man. It's like... Maybe he thought it was like, was it Ooh La La inside the Sports Almanac? Can I remember? Yeah. Ooh La La!
Opens it up and said there's pictures of Unreal in it.
Oh, man. Jeez, oh, there you go. That's testament to how realistic the Dead or Alive 2 girls looked back then, didn't it?
Yeah, they did.
But
it was all about Naomi, mate. You do have that zombie revenge piece. You have the House of the Dead piece. And you start seeing that synergy between the two then. And that it starts really to ram home. The Dreamcast, it just felt like the Dreamcast could do it all. You've got these massive pictures of Blue Stinger with these huge, huge shiny creatures on all these lighting effects and explosions and stuff. And then you've got House of the Dead 2, which, you know, that's Naomi, but you in your head, you know that it's going to look exactly the same on the Dreamcast. And it really was. Which of these are going to be available at launch? Which ones do I need to grab?
Aye. Your mind was and over. I mean, the first thing I'm thinking is I need to get one of these as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And that's whenever my mind turned to importing. Now, obviously, we'll get to that in due course. And, you know, Charlie at CA Games had managed to get one, and it was just before the turn of the new year. He got one in, because if I remember, it was kind of early January that I first seen like Sonic Adventure actually in the flesh. But again, we'll get to kind of memory seeing the console in the flesh for the first time. But aye, you're actually seeing Naomi. And I'm trying to see in this if there was any actual confirmation of just how close to Dreamcast that Naomi was. At that point, I'm not seeing anything actually mentioning that, you know, Naomi and Dreamcast were so aligned. You know, obviously, there was more VRAM available in the Naomi, and I think it's slightly faster processor-wise. But you've seen in what's come to pass that Naomi ports on Dreamcast are absolutely spot on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, this was now a new Sega arcade technology with even more games that looked insane. And so you're already salivating at the thought of these Model 3 games. Now you're adding Naomi games on it. It's like spoiled.
It really was.
It was literally like, it was, your eyeballs were bleeding, flicking every page, because all that was going through your mind with every preview, every feature was, we're going to be playing this, we're going to be playing this, we're going to be playing. It's just, and at that point, it just felt like the thing about, you know, and again, I remember whenever we first seen Shenmue, whenever Sam and I were in CA Games and Shenmue came in and the shipment from Japan, and he opened it up and Charlie fired it in. And as we watched, not having a clue what was being said, and we watched that intro, and I just remember Charlie jumping up and shouting, "Lord Sega has spoken." Right? And that's what this felt. This was like, Sega are back, man. They've learned from everything from the Saturn 32X Mega CD. This is a streamlined, powerful, well-priced, social, online, you know, games machine. What the hell can go wrong? It's got everything going for it. You know, it did feel like this thing was going to be under your TV for like years to come. Like, nothing was touching this.
No. And this is what they said, you know, on the reveal, that it was going to be the leading games technology all the way into the year 2000. And I think it's kind of a point to go back to now is on that original reveal, and we're seeing all this stuff and we're getting hyped and we're seeing all these games that are coming out at launch and then in the and near launch and in that whole window. And then we look at, you know, the Western launch date, and note that they said that they wanted to put it back to the back end of 1999 and bring with it 20 launch games, which, you know, that was what they wanted to do. That's what they'd kind of needed to do with the Saturn.
Yes.
But it did mean that that for all this stuff that we were seeing in the Sega Saturn magazine, especially with that final magazine kind of signing off saying, that's it, we're out of here now.
Right.
You know, there was no Sega presence in the market, on the shelves, anywhere, and it just kind of made that wait even more difficult to get through.
Yeah, it created a vacuum that the others, namely Sony, filled, you know, with, you know, rumors. And I always remember, like, literally there only had to be the mere mention of a rumor of PlayStation 2 and it was enough to take any attention away. But I think, again, Sega creating and trying to be proactive and do the right thing in association with, you know, Bernie's words, not Saturn's not our future, they kind of just created this vacuum of an almost year-long wait where nothing, and Sega had no presence. All of a sudden, and having the tiny presence of the Saturn would still have been better than having nothing.
Yeah.
You know, just to take your presence away entirely, and all you were left with was clearance stock, essentially. Saturn's been slashed in price, the games being put in bargain buckets, bottom shelves. Well, they already were in bottom shelves in some shops whenever it was at its peak.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just felt like they just, well, it's coming, the good stuff's coming, but you need to wait a really long time for it because they want to give you the best launch possible, but we've got, like, no presence.
Yeah.
And that ultimately, it was a catch-22, and it did backfire on them.
It did, and you kind of wish that somehow they were able to fill that gap with consoles, but as we know, when the, you know, we've talked just now about the adverts in the magazine that were saying, you know, put down your deposit, you can get your Dreamcast for £395 with a game. Which sounded like it was, which wasn't a bad deal at all, pretty good deal. And you kind of think, yeah, well, if there's no Saturn presence on the shelves, can't we get this Dreamcast out? But then the launch comes around, and that's when kind of the stock shortages hit. And the one of my most vivid memories around this time is, yes, we see buy a Dreamcast for $395 and it's the issue of Sega Saturn magazine. The Dreamcast comes out, there's these reports of stock shortages. And I remember in the Computer and Video Games issue with the Sonic Adventure review in, that there's ads in that for Dreamcast, but they're, now they're saying get your Dreamcast for £999 because obviously they're that sought after and that hard to come by. Oh, and you were saying just before we came on that Sega could have sold an extra 300,000 if it wasn't for the shortage.
That's right, yeah, the NEC chip shortage for Power VR chip, it just stripped away supply. I mean, to go back to what I was saying, because there'll be probably people that will be going, well, how could you say that the vacuum Sega created be detrimental whenever they had the most successful launch in entertainment history in North America? And they had the same length of time wait. But I think what that launch proved is because of the way after the initial period it fell off a cliff, is that I think everybody who wanted a Dreamcast got one in that initial period. Yeah. There was no lasting. It was like there was enough of a hype there to capture the Sega hardcore that had stayed faithful, and people who were, you know, intrigued enough to pick one up because of the price point, and the launch games were very, very good. But it wasn't enough. I think a lot of people were lost in that year. I think a lot of people who are maybe more kind of casual Sega fans, or Sega fans who, dare I say, grew up, you know, maybe moved on.
Yeah,
the PlayStation, because they were, Sony were smart. You know, was it Final Fantasy VIII came out the same day?
Yeah,
$9.99. You know, they're no stupid Sony. They know what they're doing. So, you know, they're still releasing a major franchise, a major sequel on PlayStation to the Final Fantasy franchise the same day Dreamcast is launching. If you couldn't pick up a Dreamcast, or you'd been fed up waiting, the year was too long, Sega suddenly became old news, that PlayStation became very appealing.
Yeah,
and then those people who were converted in that year off, then went on to buy PlayStation 2s. So yeah, that's what I mean by it being detrimental, that zero presence. They kind of diluted their own influence, so to speak.
Yeah, because you can see in the ads, like for gameplay, where, you know, the mail order games company, that you can buy a PlayStation at this point for £89. You know, if you can't get hold of a Dreamcast, it's four times as much. You've got to wait another 18 months to get it. You know, that looks, suddenly, as you say, it looks very appealing. And then if you got a PlayStation, and then you get the hype and the FUD around coming from the Sony camp, and you get all these pre-rendered CGI trailers, and you get told that Toy Story 2 can be rendered in real time on the PlayStation, and that is backwards compatible with the games that you just bought, which on the cheap, and suddenly that big gap that Sega have left is extremely detrimental. But I know from my perspective, and I'm assuming yours as well, is that, you know, that silence, that void, that gap there is where Dreamcast suddenly becomes just so irresistible. And when did you first clap eyes on one in the flesh? So was it at Charlie's?
It was at Charlie's, aye. And as I say, I can close my eyes and I can see myself walking in, because at that point he had the expanded shop. Mm-hmm. So he used to have a shop, as I said before, it's like an upside down L when it was very small in the Saturn City. So if you think, if you walk in, it's an upside down L. Cash desk was in the corner, the Saturn Japanese stuff was always running up above his head at the counter, and the Saturn stuff was round to the side of the L round the corner. And that's when me and Sam would just stand and pick up cases and imagine we had money to buy everything. But whenever he bought the store next door, and he knocked the wall through and expanded it, so you'd walk in the normal door and it was up to the right, up the far corner, he had a small 14-16 inch CRT and the Dreamcast sitting beside it. Mm-hmm. So it would have been like, it wasn't just before, it was January 90, because he got it in pretty soon, because he had what is the boy's name? Oh, you can see his face as well. But this was a guy, he spoke fluent Japanese, he was always over in Japan, and I believe it was him that brought one back. So it would have been like in that early to mid-January that I first seen it, and what struck me most about it, first seeing it, was how bloody small it was. Like, you'd seen pictures of it, but to actually see it, now, bear in mind, like, you're talking about it was up in a corner, so you had all these shelves where you stock pickup cases and stuff, and then there was, like, mind the big cardboard cubes you used to get that had, like different sides, like game cases to promote like different games that on sale, with those sitting up. CRT was in between it, and then the Dreamcast was sitting there. I remember, and he had the controller wire that done my nut in, man. I could never the cable wrapped around. I was like, reading, and he was sitting up behind, and just seeing it. And it was Sonic Adventure was the first game. It wasn't even Virtua Fighter. I didn't see Virtua Fighter 3 in the flesh until I got my own. So it was like, Sonic Adventure was the first game I seen like running, and it was, the shop was empty, well, quiet, well, empty, quiet, because it was based up at the top of Byers Road, so it was like, just if you go across Great Western Road from Byers Road again, Stewie, you'll know what I'm talking about, and it's Queen Margaret Drive, the BBC Scotland headquarters used to be there. So Charlie had a massive clientele of journalists, students, and like staff of the BBC, including there was like camera guy, like cameramen and like sound guys, and these buddies, very affluent, you know, with their fancy Glasgow University accents, you know, talking, you know, so it was a very kind of affluent, you know, audience that he had, clientele. But whenever the shop was quiet, he let me play it, and when I got to Mystic Ruin. And that's why the theme from Mystic Ruins is locked in there. Like, when I hear that tune, I just get taken back to standing there with a controller, looking up at that tiny wee CRT in the corner, and just being blown away. Like, the train for Mystic Ruins will leave. That's like,
you know, didn't say that in the version.
Didn't say that. No, I was like, from a Japanese version, it was. It was just, and I always remember that. Obviously, you see like Sonic watching Tails crash, and Shogun I won, it's like it dashes off after him, and then that's when you start the first level proper. It's like,
yeah.
Oh my god, because the graphics in the actual game always found were far more detailed than like the exploration parts and the cutscene parts.
Yeah.
They were so much more detailed, and textured and everything, and like everybody talks about the killer wheel, but right, it's been done to death, the killer wheel bit chasing you, the planks going flying. You imagine seeing that for the first time in January 1999, you are losing your shit. Like, again, you know, you go over the springs, boing, 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 up, you go through, round the loop, you run through the wee tunnel where the spikes fall down, you dodge them, you get the wee monkey guy, you hit him, and then you get your speed boots, and then you run along that wall. You know, if you can't go low, but if you can stick to the wall on the left hand side, you go right through that tunnel at the top end, and you go through and you come over the dolphins and the sun clears coming down. It was just unbelievable to see that at that point in time, and again, didn't matter, you could understand a word of it.
No,
you know, you just didn't care. It was just like, this looks incredible. It's like everything they had been saying to that point was true. It was like, and that's what struck me. And we've since, obviously, I've been talking to John Linneman as well, on X, and he's kind of, because I was quite critical of PS2 and his Jaggies, and John was kind of talking about the way that Dreamcast actually renders things, and that it quite cleverly used CRT technology to, it kind of worked with it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it did have good anti-aliasing compared to, like, PS2 is a lot harder to do anti-aliasing at the start, but Dreamcast kind of had it, and in combination with on a CRT, it was so smooth. Like, it was detailed, but like, you couldn't see a rough edge.
No,
that's what struck me. It was just so smooth, unbelievable.
No, I was playing my Power Dreamcast just now on a CRT, but it does look really smooth. But I didn't see one until my friend Charlie got one. And we both said they were going to get them. And he managed to save up and sell a lot more stuff first. I mean, he sold so much stuff. He sold his whole Saturn library, which included Deep Fear, Radiant Silver Gun, and a bunch of other stuff. And he bought his home. I wanted to keep hold of the stuff, so I had to wait until my next pay packet to get it, which was a couple of weeks later. But yeah, he bought it, but he had a PC monitor because his dad worked with was in IT, and he had a bunch of monitors and stuff. So he bought the VGA adapter and brought that home, and that was just like it was so sharp, it was unbelievable. And obviously, I don't know. What you were saying about it working with the CRT in order for it to work the jaggies out, because it wasn't like we had a load of jaggies on there. It just seemed like a pristine picture. But yeah, obviously this is a VGA on a CRT at the time, and it just that picture just looks absolutely perfect. But he bought a SCART adapter as well, and we were playing it on the downstairs telly, and we were playing it in front of his brother and his brother's mate, and we went through the bit with the dolphins. And he went, "This part is just pure eye candy." And it was just like, we laughed, but it was like, it was true. It was just, yeah, you know, when you see the glare coming through and the dolphins crisscrossing over the top, it's just absolutely a wonderful moment. I was playing it, as I said, I was playing Sonic Adventure earlier on today, and it's just, you know, it's still a good looking game, even though it has aged. And those set pieces really do take me back. And I as soon as I saw that, I couldn't wait to get my own. I'd seen he bought Sonic Adventure and he bought Sega Rally, and we played both. I was playing Sonic Adventure like deep into the night, and then I woke up before he did. I was trying to sneak a game on it. And I turned it on, but what happened? The Dreamcast VMU went bing, woke him up.
you've got the beep, and then between that and then
yeah,
the loudest disc drive in the world.
Yeah.
It's like the calm before the storm, isn't it? Whenever it does that wee whir, then it just off it goes.
So I imagine that next for you was picking up your own one.
Yes, mate. So I worked part-time. I was a student, obviously, and I worked part-time at Safeway, stacking the grocery shelves. Great time, no responsibilities, bunch of students, pub after work, didn't care. But I was obviously putting money away towards that, towards a Dreamcast. And I've told the story on here before, but I had a Cyrix 686 MX Windows 95 PC that I had for college work, and I went on Microsoft Paint and I made the jankiest looking custom wallpaper in Paint, and it was just a white with a picture of a Dreamcast, and basically just put days until and I was counting it down. I was meant to get it for my birthday in May, and it turned out I'd saved enough money for just over half of it, and my mum and my uncle chipped in the rest of it to let me to go and get it early. So it was in early April 99 that I finally got to pick mine up. I think I was 475 or 485 or something. It was stupid, but it came with a step down and a copy of EF3. And it was the big orange box with the clear handle on the top and all the pictures in the back for the various kind of adverts in Japan. And like, see, whenever that box get handed over to me, it was like, oh my, it's the first machine I'd imported, the first machine I'd put any of my own money to. And I think, like, again, there's people you speak to, like even John Lennon said that, like, the Dreamcast is the first console he paid for with his own money. It's like, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people at that age, like, the Dreamcast does have that element of that. We paid something or all of our own money towards it, but just like my palms were sweating going home. Like, I just could not fucking wait to get in the door, and then you undone the wee cups, and then the flipped open with a nice lid, and you had the wee brown carton wrapped in the plastic bag, and you took it out, and obviously you'd all your manuals and your controller stuff, get the step down plugged in, get your wee two-pronged Japanese plug into that, and it came with it was an Innovation RGB SCART cable that it came with as well. So put that in. If I remember, I had my 4x3, I think I had was it the Toshiba that I had at that point, with the grey one with the matching stand, it's got the kind of smoke glass door in the front, and put it into that, loaded up VF3 TV, and just sitting there going, I can't believe this is a nice. It was like, you're the track mode, it's like, oh my god, like Akira's got fingers, like like what he knocked Wolf's hat off, what is happening here? It's like, oh, you know, your select screen, you're picking your pick Akira, and then you get the amazing splash screens before every fight, it was mind-blowing to bring that home, to see that, because again, people go on about the quality or lack of quality of that port, and it gets poorly and badly chastised, but you're going, as you've pointed out, mate, Tekken 3 had come out not long before. It got a PlayStation port, and don't get me wrong, that is a damn good port on a PS1 Tekken 3. Yeah. It's a really, really good port. Had a lot of fun with it. Really impressive, but for me, that was just Tekken catching up with VF2.
Yeah,
And then I've brought this thing in. You know, it's just, it was light years ahead. Absolute light years.
It was, mate. It was. I mean, I got mine, as I say, 2 weeks after my friend got his. And the irony of it is, I didn't pick up Sonic Adventure. So I was going to. So I picked up Sega Rally. I went in there, and I traded in Dragon Force, X-Men Children of the Atom, Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and a few other ones. But still kept hold of most of my Sega Saturn games at the time. I only traded in about 8 of them because I'd saved the money up. And I had a little bit, I think I got a little bit more for a couple of them than I expected. And so you can get something else. And on the shelf was The House of the Dead 2. And all we'd seen at that point is the about 2 or 3 screenshots in Sega Saturn magazine, which I'd actually forgotten about. And I was like, when the hell did this come out? And of course, you know, I love House of the Dead 1, which I'd only played, 12 months before. So that came home, and Charlie was like, look, if you get House of the Dead, play that, swap it, and I'll get, we can have my Sonic Adventure. And then, so I ended up buying House of the Dead, and it was just like, I was like, you mate, I couldn't wait to get it home, but I had to travel back from, I got mine from Watford, actually, because they'd just opened a CEX in Watford, and that's where I got it from. So I was coming back on the bus home, you know, holding this big bag of a brand new console and everything, Sega Rally, a VMU, step-down converter. At the time, in CEX, they were selling them for $199.99, but I've got this is the very console right here. And it doesn't have a modem, or it didn't have a modem.
It's the Hong Kong
version.
Yeah,
which may be why it was cheaper than.
It's got a modem. Is that a BNC Terminator module?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, it's in the slot. And it came in a white box as well.
I've still got the box for this one as well.
Aye. I mean, just because they didn't have the online services in that region, that's all it was. I mean, it's still the same machine, so.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
Yeah, so I absolutely loved it. I was showing it off to my mates and stuff. Someone was asking to rent it off me. That's absolutely no way. But yeah, mate, and then after that, the rest is kind of history. I was, I bought Sonic Adventure for myself not long after. Played that absolutely to death. I think I had every character had 99 lives on it.
That doesn't surprise me, mate, when it comes to Sonic.
No, I mean, I'm still playing. I'm still bloody playing it today. So there you go. But that's pretty much the journey, mate, wasn't it? And it's kind of insane to think that was all 25 years ago. And that's again, these are memories and a console, and it's games that live long in our hearts.
Yeah. And I mean, you go through, you know, and as we've been speaking, there's been footage running of various Dreamcast games, not just the launch stuff, but just kind of games that we all love on the system. But, you know, things that followed, you know, like Soul Calibur, Crazy Taxi, Shenmue, Skies of Arcadia, you know, Virtual On, Oratorio, Tangram, just so many iconic titles that would come, that each one were just a visual feast. Every one of them just looked and played amazing, you know. So yeah, the kind of the promise of beating Model 3 never did come to fruition, but that's not to say that the Dreamcast didn't live up to its promise of being as powerful, because it sure as hell is. It eclipsed everything that had come before it. And as I've said before, as someone who had PS2 at launch, that first 12 months there was nothing on PS2. And, you know, I know Ridge Racer 5 plays great, but DOA 2 was, yeah, it had nicer lighting effects and it extra costumes, extra stages, but it looked nothing like the Naomi game. It looked nothing like the Dreamcast version. The bouncer, absolute dung. I think, was it, did that come with a demo of, I don't know, you bought Zone of Enders just to get a demo of Metal Gear Solid 2. You know, again, I wasn't a great fan of that. I just was buying so much stuff in that first 12 months for PS2 to try and justify why I had bought the thing. And my Dreamcast is sitting there going, look at you just trying to justify buying this whenever I'm sitting here. So it was just, as I say, it didn't quite beat Model 3, but in its own way, it blazed the path to what we see today. And it had innovations in it that, you know, set the industry on a certain path, which is, I guess, Sega's defining legacy with Dreamcast, is that they took the industry down the path that we're on just now with online and multiplayer, you know. So it's an iconic system. It deserves its place in history.
I will say, even though that it never quite got to kind of Model 3 beating, although you probably could make a case for some games, especially the kind of the Naomi ones, but what I will say is I never stopped being amazed by what it was doing from beginning to end. From, you know, Virtua Fighter 3 TB all the way to Shenmue 2. Obviously, we had Rez after that, but Shenmue 2 was kind of the last big release.
Yeah.
From beginning to end, I'd never stop being amazed by it. And I think that's probably why it still lives long in the hearts of people that are around it and why it's so popular. I think there's a cut-off point, and the Dreamcast is it, where, you know, you've had that. I think Jim Ryan said that he can't go back to play PlayStation 1 games. He wants to go and play them. And there is, and I do to an extent get that games from that generation feel a bit archaic, particularly 3D ones. And the Dreamcast feels like the first modern console. You know, much like Model 3 games can look like modern games today, Dreamcast games can look like modern games. No, Virtua Tennis still looks fantastic. House of the Dead 2 still looks great. Sonic Adventure, yeah, it's aged a bit, but that still looks fantastic. And, you know, Virtua Fighter 3 TB is the flaws that it has. I mean, step away, and that still could be a modern game. Soul Calibur as well. So it was an exciting time, mate. And we both lived through that, through the rumours, through the hype, through the launch. And then when we finally got it in our hands ourselves after all that waiting, after all that planning, and after all of it had died down, and it didn't disappoint. And 25 years on, that's why we speak so highly of it still.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just laughing because I just remembered there was something that I took a screenshot of. It was actually a letter that Rich Ledbetter addresses in the final issue of Sega Saturn magazine. And Andrew Newell, via email, is asking about Dreamcast doing Model 3, and the screenshot is Scud Race with the caption, "Dreamcast can, in capital letters, do Model 3 quality visuals." Oh yes, he says. And he's answered about Scud Race. The Scud Race demo ran on a Dreamcast development hardware with less than 20% of the full machine's power. don't worry about it.
If only it came to fruition. But mate, it's been an absolute blast as usual, and it's been a wonderful trip down memory lane, this one. Like to thank our viewers and our listeners and Radio Sega. If you're in the Discord or if you're in the comments on YouTube, please give us a shout out and share your Dreamcast memories. As we say, we're trying to keep it all to in this episode just talking about our journey to getting it. Please tell, share any Dreamcast memories that you can think of about this sensational system. If you like what we do, think about becoming a member. You know, you can support what we do for just 99p. So for less than a quid, you can become a member and get all sorts of perks. And James, we have some premium members, if you'd like to give them a shout out.
Certainly will. Thank you very much to G-Man, Sega Saturn Lad, and of course Andy Mackey, the premium members there. But thank you to all our members. We're up to 8 so far, and each and every one of you, we thank you very much for your support.
Thank you very much. And even if you aren't a member, you know, nothing changes. We'll still be giving you regular Sega Guys content, and nothing changes there at all. And if you do like what we do, please like, comment and subscribe, because that really helps us out. Stay in touch. You can catch me on X at @Swooper_D. You can catch James at the Sega Holic. You can catch the account at Sega Guys. But until next time, we will see you on the Sega side.
Sega.